Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Is there a universal formula for getting and keeping power? Our next guest says there is, and it often involves what he calls bad behavior. Alistair Smith is professor of politics at NYU, New York University, and the co-author of The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Welcome, Alistair Smith.
I'm glad I could be with you.
You start by examining the city of Bell. Remind us of what happened in Bell and how this plays into your argument about bad behavior being good politics.
We regard all leaders, whether they're of corporations, sports federations, dictatorships, or democracy, as all having some basic desire in that sustained power. And this would be exactly the same with the leaders in Bell. And this was, I'm sure this hit the news in L.A. and it even made it over to New York in terms of the newspaper, that the leadership there, the Rizzo, had set up this beautiful system where he got paid around, I think it was $700,000 salary. So he was massively more paid than virtually every other elected public official in the country. And he managed to do this because he engineered a system where he could be beholden to very few people to stay in power.
You're talking about the city manager.
Absolutely. And this is the goal that all leaders, this is one of the sort of five basic principles that leaders want to have of coming to power, is they want to be beholden to very small numbers of people. They don't want to rely on many people to stay in power. And so he organized this very tiny sort of election to switch the charter of the city so it wasn't governed by the rest of the city, state of California. And this small rule change, which was a sort of an innocuous, boring, bureaucratic rule, so very few people turned up, meant that with a few hundred votes, he could actually assemble a city council that would vote through all the reforms he wanted. So his salary went up from, I think, around $150,000 to 10 years later being $700,000 plus. So he managed to do this because he could rely on very few people. And then the people on the town council that got elected with these very small numbers of voters, several hundred voters were all he needed really to keep most of these people in, they managed to vote themselves enormous salaries via special enterprise zones and special committees. That's how they got rich.
You talked about how the city then charged some 50% more for property taxes, and they just engineered this entire system of politics that resembles often what you say are dictatorship politics.
Absolutely. So one of the other fundamental rules you want to do is tax as heavily as you possibly can. Tax as heavily as the economy will bear, and the people and your supporters will pay. Well, you know, Rizzo's now got this system where he's not actually beholden to very many people. Not many people pay attention to this small-scale town politics, changing the rules and such like. And most of the council members don't require that many votes, several hundred votes, to become a member of this committee. And so what they did was they taxed very heavily, much higher taxes than richer, wealthier neighbors that surrounded them. They brought all this money in and they distributed it out to themselves and to favored people, but they didn't generate good public policy for the people. These are the rules. You want to reward those who are keeping you in power.
Why a small group to be beholden to? Why is that helping to keep certain people in power?
Leaders always, the best way to survive as a political leader is to reduce the number of people you need to stay in power. So this would be disenfranchising people in an electoral system is a perfect way to stay in power. That way you need the support of fewer people. So in the U.S., we see the Electoral College. That means the president only needs to win about 35 million votes to win the presidency. You typically get much more than that, but you don't need to win as many because you don't have to win half the support of half of the voters, which is what we typically think, but that's not what you need to do to actually win. So all leaders want to change the rules to get the group as small as possible. And the great thing is, if you don't have many people to reward, you can give each of them, and you, so just think of it in a very simple way. You have a pot of money. You don't have many people. They can each have a very large, each person's share of the pot of money is very large. That doesn't work once you get up into huge numbers because each person's share becomes very small. And so leaders, when they're beholden to a lot of people, they have to start producing good public policy, which is much harder to do. And it's easier for rivals to claim they can do a better job.
Now, one of the things that struck me in this book, it's actually in the very first chapter, you talk about politics not being complex, but then you say leaders are not monolithic, and it's silly to think that they are in control of their jurisdictions, whether they're countries or companies. And you take a look back at old France. What can we learn from old France, and how does this all come together?
Well, this is the great thing. So we tend to think of, you know, these regimes, we call them absolute monarchs when we think of sort of Louis XIV. He's an absolute monarch. You know, everything he said was law. Well, everything he said was law because the people that were enforcing the system agreed with him, everything that he said being law, because he was paying them a lot. So no leader stays in power by themselves. So whether we want to think of it as a corporation, or we want to think of it as a sports federation, or we want to think of it as a democracy, you have to have supporters to keep you in there to make the rules. So everybody relies upon keeping these supporters happy. So that's the simple objective of political leaders, is to keep these people happy to stay in power. The difference between all the different, how the different systems function, is the number of people that you have to keep happy.
And you talk about these three groups of peoples. You call them dimensions. Mm-hmm. You say they're consistent across governments, whether democracies or dictatorships. Explain these three groups of people, the nominal, real, selectorate, and the winning coalition, and how do we see them in both dictatorships and in democracies?
Yep. So when we tend to think about political organizations, we tend to think democracy and non-democracy, or a junta or a dictatorship. But what we don't realize is that there's enormous variation within those categories. So we want to, instead of thinking about that all democracies are the same and all autocracies are the same and all hunters are the same, we want to think about them on a continuum of scales. So the simplest scale is the winning coalition. How many supporters does a leader need? So we can think, here we've done some expert surveys asking sort of country experts, how many people does this leader really need? So it could be from a few hundred in some of the most autocratic systems like North Korea up to 35 million people in the United States to be president. So they can vary enormously. Then we want to think about, who really has some say. So in a democracy, that tends to be all adults. Or all adult citizens, I should say. So in the U.S., there's about 160 million registered voters. So that's the selectorate, and that's the people who get the choice. In other systems, it could be much lower. If we were in a monarchy, then we'd only be really worrying about aristocrats. If we were in a junta, we'd be worrying about the senior generals. So we want to worry about how many people we have to pick to be supporters, and how big a pool can we draw supporters from.
So what you're saying is the broader the selectorate, the more likely you'll have a system that is more democratic in nature and more perhaps egalitarian?
This is a classic mistake we want to think of. So you use the term selectorate there. So this is the pool of people who have some nominal say. So this would be an electorate. And in the U.S. system where we have fixed electoral rules, you're absolutely right that the more people we bring into the electorate, the more the coalition of supporters of political leader needs, because we actually obey the electoral rules. But actually, this is one of the points we make in the book, is that rigged elections are sort of a terrible thing for the people. So in those kind of systems, what we do is we allow everyone to vote, but the votes really don't count. We know that that's not really the important point. It actually depends upon not who votes, but who counts. And it turns out the counters are the important people in an electoral system, in a corrupt electoral system. And one of the beautiful things about, and it's exactly the opposite to what you just said, is by making the electorate larger, we make the society more equal. We do exactly the opposite. What we do is we make the leader could still be beholden to a small number of people, but the corrupt electoral system allows the leader to find lots and lots of replacements. There's nothing special about people in positions of power in a democracy. They can be replaced by anybody. You can always rig another election to get somebody out of the parliament and bring back another crony. So it's not the electorate we should worry about. It's how many people matter.
You wrote about once these coalitions are put together by leaders in order to put them in power, that it often changes once they reach power. You use the example of Fidel Castro. What happened with Fidel Castro?
This is a classic case that all leaders face. Is when you come to power, you need the people who are in positions of authority now, for example, people in control of the army, people in charge of the police, to support you coming to power, or voters of the current regime in a democracy to turn against the incumbent to bring you to power. So you're very constrained in who you can choose when you try to come to power. When you put your coalition of supporters together, you've got to, in some sense, include some of the old guys because you needed them to come to you so that you could kick the incumbent out. But once you get there, you've got the problem that, well, these people have already demonstrated they're not very loyal. They just helped you bring down the previous guy. So you should sit there and think, I would like to get my cronies in, the people who are really loyal to me, people who only have a standing in society because of me, who won't be good rivals. And so then what leaders like to do is try and weed out the people they suspect of being disloyal and replace them with people that they think will be loyal over the long term. And so we see lots of culling of people when they come in. So we can think of some other classic examples. So as you pointed out, Castro, he wiped out most of the cronies that fought alongside him in, you know, the rebel movements. Very usual. People fighting, comrade in arms, they get into power. One guy comes in charge, all the other guys suddenly become traitors. Very familiar story. You could think of Adolf Hitler had, you know, the famous sort of Night of the Long Knives. The black shirts turned up and the SS turned up and took away all the brown shirts, his previous sort of paramilitary organization. Complete sort of culling overnight happened.
Do you see that much in democratic settings?
Well, we do. We don't see the violence. George W. Bush came to power, you know, with Christian conservatives. You don't see him, you know, dropping factions of the you don't see, you know, factions that he's no longer supporting their positions. We don't see them being knifed. But we do see that politicians come to power and they will move their support base. So they won't adopt, so they come to power promising to do X, Y, and Z, and maybe they do X and Y. They don't do Z. So some of the people are going to want to move from them, and at the same time, they'll be trying to attract supporters they think are going to be more likely to support them if they give them their policies. So we see this politicians, as we all know, never completely honest about what they're going to do. Once they get in, they'll shift who they support.
So in essence, you say these rulers come into power with coalitions, then they shake them up, replace them, then allocate money to keep their new coalition happy, but not too happy, and then give enough to the rest to keep them from revolting.
That's right. You've been reading the book very carefully. You sort of summarized the rules, right? You want to get in a small number of people as possible from a big pool. You want to tax very heavily, which is sort of the one thing we haven't talked a huge amount about. Then you pay off the coalition. And then make sure you keep some money for yourself. Don't be too nice to the people. That's exactly what all good leaders who want to keep their job should do. And leaders get into trouble when they fail to follow these rules.
It's very Machiavellian, no?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been accused of being very cynical. But cynical doesn't mean wrong. Cynical just means we believe it's both cynical and extremely accurate way to describe how politics works. And it is a cynical Machiavellian approach, but, you know, we spend a large portion of the end of the book developing ideas. We tell you how the system works. So this is how you fix it. You can't fix a system unless you understand how it works. You don't take your car to a mechanic if the mechanic has no idea how a car runs. They can't make your car work better if they don't understand how it works. So we spend a lot of time developing these rules and explaining how the system works, and then we tell you how you're going to fix the system.
You say leaders support those who support them or who will keep them in power, but couldn't it be the reverse? That their concern for a certain ideology dictates the bloc.
We don't deny that ideology and culture, that they exist, but we just think they're very convenient labels. So we can identify by these labels who's going to be rewarded and who's going to be punished. So if we want to think about, for example, in the U.S., we got the jobs bill. We can think of this as sort of a big ideological thing. Is it class warfare? Do we want to tax? Do we want tax and spend? Do we want to let free markets reign? We can think of a lot of ideological labels being used in this debate. But what it really comes down to is these labels are telling us who's going to win. Who's going to profit under the scheme if a leader comes in, and who's going to suffer? So let's take the extreme here. We've got, let's cut taxes. Well, who would benefit if we're going to cut taxes? Rich people are going to benefit if we cut taxes. Well, who tends to be rich? Republicans tend to be rich. They're going to like these policies. If we think about job creation, Obama keeps talking about, you know, he wants money for teachers and public service employees and construction workers. Well, who's going to benefit from those? Well, unions, teachers, construction workers tend to be Democrats. So he's basically talking about transferring. So we may think of these as ideology, but we're really just identifying groups that are going to be rewarded under different sets of policies.
It could be that they actually believe in these policies, and so do those other people. Perhaps people on one side really want to stay in power in order to make sure the system is more egalitarian.
This is always, of course, we don't get the opportunity to see people act outside of this chicken or egg thing. So we have to look for a few examples of where people switch policies. So let me give you two. Let me give you an example, an American example, and then I'll move to a more extreme example. So think of a famous American politician, Strom Thurmond. So Strom Thurmond was a huge segregationist. He took positions that were highly racist right up until the Civil Rights Acts came through, and suddenly he found out he had a constituency that was full of blacks. What did he do as soon as he had that? He completely switched the sets of policies he wanted. He went from this group should be disadvantaged to, oh, I have to rely upon a lot of this group now. I'm going to switch my policies. So here's a politician who knew what he needed to do and what he needed to do to stay in power shifted, so he changed policies. I can give you an even more extreme example, which is actually one of the few cases Bruce and I identified as a leader, an individual who's ruled two countries at the same time. Lots of people do it like you're the queen of one country and therefore you're, you know, a ruler of an empire, but as actually two independent countries. So King Leopold of Belgium also ruled the Congo, but he ruled that as he set this up as a private company that went over and captured the Congo for himself. So when he was back at home, he believed in liberal ideas, unions, promoting working standards and healthcare for an education for the people. And in the Congo, he was a brutal killer of anyone who resisted him in any way that stopped him making money on rubber. So we have to ask ourselves, leaders are doing what gets them in power and wealth. They're not adopting the same ideological conditions under two different circumstances.
Is this really applicable in the general sense, or are you taking a single individual and trying to say that all leaders are like him because he's the one example we have where you see a double ideology?
No, I think that's not that. We see changes at all. So one of the descriptions we spend a lot of time talking about was a classic reformer, which was Jerry Rawlings in Ghana. So we spend a lot of time talking about JJ, he was known as, Junior Jesus. He was a bit of a charismatic character in Ghana. Instituted a socialist revolution when he first came into power and wanted to pay the army and promote socialist ideas and damp out opposition to himself. This was right up until he ran out of money. And then we see him radically changing his policies, liberalizing, and he actually became the sort of poster boy for IMF reforms and then liberalizing democracy. But he didn't do this because he wanted to. He did this because he had to.
Is it that particular kinds of people pursue leadership?
We often get asked this. So people ask us, do you believe that all leaders are sort of nasty and brutish and self-interested? And the answer to that question is, well, first I scratched my head. I was like, all the words made sense, but put together, of course, they do. Yeah, what else could you possibly think? Is it possible that there are people who are less self-interested around the world? I suspect that that might be true. We could vary on that degree. But the point is, those kind of people are not going to run for political office. So we might ask ourselves, political leaders, seizing power in a democracy involves taking hideously violent acts and brutal suppression of opposition and often killing people. People who aren't interested in coming to power and paying those costs aren't the kind of people who become leadership roles. We shouldn't worry. So within the set of leaders, I think it's incredibly clear that they're all self-interested louts.
So it is the kind of person that finds himself or herself pursuing a position of leadership.
I tend to think, not everybody wants to be the leader of a country. I personally think it would be, being a leader would be a horrible job. But the set of people that do, there's a lot of people who want to pursue power. There is no shortage of claimants to the throne, shall we say.
Is it possible for benevolent types, altruistic or symbiotic types, to be able to reach and keep leadership if, in fact, you are right about the process it takes to get into power and stay in power?
So you're maybe thinking, we have our Plato philosopher kings. Wouldn't this be perfect? Our benevolent dictator, he could just do the right thing.
I'm thinking not necessarily benevolent dictator. I'm thinking Jimmy Carter. Obviously, he didn't stay in office. So he pursued power, but he didn't keep power. Could we have people who are actually truly concerned about the plight of people?
I think you can, but they can't always act upon that all the time. So the first thing is, even if you want to really help the people, you can't help the people unless you stay in power. So the first and foremost job you have to do, even if you want to, in some sense, spend all the discretion you have on helping the people, is stay in power. And staying in power relies on keeping your cronies happy. So in a democracy, that actually generally means doing things that are good for the public good, because you have to keep so many people happy in the first place. You may as well work towards the public good in some sense. In an autocracy, it's very hard to spend money helping the people if that takes money out the pocket of your cronies. So we could think of a classic example would be Julius Caesar, right? There's a lot of confusion about him. Everybody thinks he's this guy who wants to be king in Rome. The reality is he went around reforming the roads, laying out the city, getting the water working, organizing the calendar, tons of things. But he made a big mistake, was he also started canceling debts of the common people to promote the economy. Well, of course, he relied upon members of the Senate and powerful rich people who were that owned this debt. They were very unhappy about this, and so they stabbed him down. So you can only be good if it comes out of your pocket, not out of your cronies' pocket.
You know, you reminded me of this section of your book about infrastructure and education, and I was struck by the leader, the African leader, who said to the Rwandan president, don't build roads because then those are more roads they can come and get you with. And the only roads to develop are the ones that help you get out when you need to.
Absolutely. And he was quite ruthless in his pursuit of power and maintenance of power. He didn't give a damn about the people of Zaire. They lived miserable, miserable lives. Let me give you another example rather than just the roads, which he did. He inherited like 70,000 miles of roads. And when he left, you know, several decades later, it was only like 6,000 miles of roads left. He got rid of them, just let them decompose. But he actually decided he was going to run his copper mines that were down in the south of the country with hydroelectric power stations from the river right near where he controlled in the north. So he ran a power line basically close to 1,000 miles across the country. And he actually went out of his way to bypass all the cities and towns on the way so that no one have electrification. But he maintained the key thing was that since he then controlled the power supply, he could turn off the copper production. If anyone else tried to steal it and seize control and get the wealth from the copper mines, he could control that copper mine. So he was focusing on bringing the wealth to him.
And similar with education.
Absolutely. Want to educate people. If you're an autocrat, you want to educate people to the extent that they can do the jobs you need them to do. And so educating them more than that, giving people an advanced education, people learn how to organize against you. And we saw that leaders in Egypt, for example, got in trouble because they had a large number of educated and underemployed people who could organize protests against them. If you keep the people poor and ignorant and separated, very, very hard for them to organize against you.
Let's talk for a moment about the corporation, because you say these apply also to corporations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And specifically with the same kinds of rules, but then also how corruption really helps. How does it help these leaders?
Well, so the reality is we think of the classic economic model is the company is out there maximizing profit. They're not maximizing profit. They're not helping companies. Leaders want to stay at the top of their corporations, and so they have to keep the support of people. So who are the supporters in a publicly traded company? We'd like to think it's the shareholders, but you and I are all own some kind of share, and occasionally we get those proxy forms through the mailbox, right? And what's the first thing we do with that? We look and I don't understand what this is, and we throw it away. So most of the time we have a nominal say, we have a vote, but our votes don't matter. Control of publicly traded corporation comes down to the board, a few senior management, and a few big institutional investors. So that's typically tens of people. It's rarely more than tens of people. And yet these can be huge multi-billion dollar organizations.
When we look at a system where there is considerable corruption, you say that if we do things like increase sentencing, look at legislative fixes, they're counterproductive in part because they give leverage to the powerful. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, let's stay on the sort of business environment now. We just sort of said, you know, corporations are run with a relatively small group of supporters, and we want to know why people are on occupying Wall Street screaming about why Wall Street is so tone deaf to the plight of the people. It's because the leader's beholden to this small number of people, and how should they be rewarding them with big bloated consultancies and big private fees for running corporations, and executive salaries should be huge. So we get this kind of corruption. And so what we're seeing is we expect to see these big salaries. So, you know, the call at the moment for reform is let's outlaw these large salaries and everything. And this is a terrible thing to do because this is the basis of corruption. Would we sooner see things paid illegally rather than legally? If the basis of political power is rewarding a small number of people, it's always going to be involving large amounts of transfers of cash. So, you know, we see this in the Olympic Committee. We see huge bribes being paid for votes to locate the Olympics in a particular city. So outlawing things, ignoring the underlying political incentive, is always the wrong way to go. And I think you're pointing to the section of the book where we say, if you make a law against sort of taking bribes and bad behavior, all you really do is empower the person who gave out the bribe, but they now have evidence to keep people in line even more.
And so you say the incentive system itself should perhaps be changed.
Absolutely. There's no point changing a rule. So, you know, if you take a salary above $10 million, you've broken the law. Because then people are going to start trying to reward supporters through the back door, so long as leaders are beholden to a small number of people. So what you want to do is you've got to change the actual governance structure. So if we go to the sort of the Olympic Bribe Committee, which is something many people are familiar with, the Salt Lake City bribery, every year there's huge amounts of bribery, and I'm a huge soccer fan. FIFA's full of bribery about where they're going to locate the World Cup of soccer. Every year it's... But the reason is there's lots of bribery because so few people are involved in making that decision. All we have to do is to make those decisions get made better and outlaw corruption is simply have the decision depend upon more people.
How would that apply in governance?
In a corporation, we want to...
I meant in political governance.
Political governments, well, we want to make the President of the United States more accountable to the people. We should get rid of the Electoral College. The president would overnight have to appeal to twice the number of people he currently has to appeal to. So at the moment, you need to win half the seats in, you know, sort of half the states. Win even less because some states are overrepresented in the Electoral College. So half the seats, so that's in half the you need half the votes in half the states, so that's 25% of the vote. If you got rid of the Electoral College, all of a sudden you need 50% of the vote. So instantly you make the president work much harder. He's got to keep twice as many people happy as he was before. In Congress, you get the same thing, gerrymandering. So many districts are so highly gerrymandered where the politicians pick their voters rather than the voters pick their leader that you can control Congress. Very few of the seats are competitive.
Alistair Smith, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. The name of the book is The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Thank you so much.
That'd be my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.